And this hour, of course, as we continue our discussion with Dinesh D'Souza about his work, United States of Socialism, we'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dinesh D'Souza, with us. His book is called The United States of Socialism. Dinesh, kind of paint us a picture of a United States under socialism. What would that be like?
I think the distinguishing features would be two. The first would be that there would be a lack of incentive for people to excel, to produce, to be innovative, to be creative. Why? Because in order to have socialism, in order to have this massive welfare state, you'd have to have confiscatory rates of taxation. And these rates of taxation, if you listen to people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders, these rates could go into 70 to 80%. So think of making a dollar and turning 70 to 80% over to the federal government. You're essentially working for 20 cents. Well, who's going to want to do that? And once people make a little bit of money, they're going to want to quit and then actually join the large class of people who simply collect benefits from the government. Now, many people on the left will point to Scandinavia and say, hey, that's what the Scandinavians do. And it works over there, Dinesh, so why can't it work over here? Well, first of all, that is not what the Scandinavians do. Scandinavian countries are very capitalist in wealth creation, even if they are socialist in wealth distribution. And what that means is that Scandinavian countries have low corporate income taxes, about the same as America, 20%. They have no minimum wage. Companies can hire and fire people for any reason. They have no wealth tax. They have no inheritance tax. The kind of financial transaction fees that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren want to put on Wall Street, there's no Scandinavian country that goes close to that or does any of that. So the point I want to make is the Scandinavians don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
Right.
And that's a big difference with what the socialists want to do here. So that's the first negative thing. I think that they would hurt business, innovation, creativity, and entrepreneurship. And that's what's made America the country it is.
Absolutely. Now, is socialism closer to capitalism or communism?
It's closer to communism than to capitalism because both communism and socialism involve forms of tyranny and control.
And control.
They involve a powerful state. Now, of course, socialists today in America will say, well, we want democratic socialism, not authoritarian socialism. But the point I want to make, George, is there's not a great deal of difference. You know, when I was a kid, I would go to school and I'd have some marbles in my pocket. Imagine if one guy jumps on me and takes all my marbles. Well, that's authoritarian socialism. I've been robbed by this dictator. But then let's say I join a group of 10 guys and 8 of them, a majority, decides, let's just jump Dinesh and take his marbles. Well, the result is exactly the same. It's not made more legitimate because a majority of people did exactly the same thing. I'm being robbed either way. And so the point I want to make is that democratic socialism tries to claim a kind of moral sanction because the majority has somehow signed off on it. But if you're confiscating some other guy's hard-earned labor or taking his house or taking away his wealth, you don't have any more right to do it if you're a majority as if you are one guy doing it.
And what's your motivation to try to build wealth if they keep doing that to you?
This is exactly the point. Socialism kills off incentive. It kills off creativity. Now, the other side of it is it also kills off civil liberties. You notice that in every socialist country, there's sort of a kind of socialist art, and people who go against that socialist art get banned. We're beginning to see that in this country. Suddenly, they're banning Gone with the Wind because it has a kind of old-fashioned depiction, if you will, of the old plantation. There's the idea here that corporations now have to cancel certain types of products that are out of line with the prevailing orthodoxy. All of this, I think, is very alien to the spirit of the American founding, which was essentially political freedom, economic freedom, religious freedom, and freedom of thought and expression.
Well, some of it is. I think what needs to also be done, though, is a little more sensitivity to some of these issues that are out there. Do you want a Confederate flag waving? Is that historical for the United States, or is it offensive to a lot of African Americans? And I think what we've also need to do, Dinesh, is to be a little more cognizant and sensitive to the needs of certain people without trying to implement control and everything, but just being a little more human.
Oh, I agree with that. And I think that, but I do think that the sensitivity needs to work both ways. I mean, just to look at two examples, and these deal with freedom of the press. A top editor of the New York Times was recently booted for publishing an article by Senator Tom Cotton, basically talking about the fact that when chaos in the streets reaches a certain point, you might have to call in the military. I mean, after all, if the other side has a paramilitary, then you might need to bring in the U.S. military. In the Philadelphia Inquirer, there was an editor who ran a headline, and he was talking, the headline simply said, "Buildings Matter Too." In other words, yes, Black Lives Matter, but one shouldn't treat property that belongs to someone else as if it didn't matter because somebody else's sweat and tears went into it. So buildings matter too. Result, this guy was forced to resign. So what kind of America are we living in where you can't express your opinion, you can't have a debate, you can't publish articles? And so I'm very worried about the chilling effect on civil liberty, quite apart from the confiscatory, the economic aspects of socialism.
Well, there's a great movie called Schindler's List that dealt with the Holocaust and how this great German saved a lot of Jewish people during World War II by employing them and hiding them in his factories and stuff like that. Should a movie like that be banned? Because it merely points out the horrors of what happened during World War II.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there is an effort here to sort of rewrite history and to force a narrative on us that is, in fact, not true. The slave plantation that developed in America developed starting in the 18 teens and 1820s, and it's very much connected with the rise of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party was the great political defender of the slave plantation, by the way, not just in the South, but also in the North. The Democratic Party also fought against the 13th Amendment, which ended slavery, the 14th Amendment, which gave us equal rights under the laws, the 15th Amendment, which allowed blacks to vote. The Democrats were very active in starting the Ku Klux Klan and then reviving the Klan in the 20th century. So here's the point. It's kind of strange that the very same party that did all these horrific things, that has never admitted them, never apologized for them, never paid one penny of restitution, is nevertheless the party that kind of goes on its moral high horse and tries to point to the rest of us. I mean, think of me, George. I'm an immigrant. I grew up in a different country. What possible responsibility could I have for the sins of America that occurred decades or hundreds of years ago?
Oh, same with me. I wasn't even born then.
Exactly. And so they point the finger so easily, and who's pointing the finger? The very same party that did a lot of this bad stuff. It's almost like the racial arsonists show up before the election pretending to be firefighters.
Well, these political parties, all of them, Dinesh, as you well know, will do whatever they have to do to win an election. And I think the Democrats, you know, smell the possibility of the White House, and they're doing everything they can to try to get to it. And I have never seen in my lifetime watching administrations. And, you know, the first president that I could remember was JFK and then all the subsequent ones. I have never seen an administration under fire as much as this one in all my career. And you've got to, I guess, believe the same thing.
Yeah, I think we've seen a kind of gangsterization of American politics. That's occurred in the last 10 or so years. I mean, this is really not the Democratic Party of Jimmy Carter, and most certainly not of Truman or JFK. So I think we've seen a dark turn. And by the way, we've been talking a little bit about some of the sort of thugs on the street. I want to also emphasize the thugs with badges. And by this, I mean, I'm talking here about the deep state, the police agencies of the government. And this would be the IRS, the FBI, the DOJ, the CIA. So these agencies are supposed to be neutral. But sometimes what can happen is they get corrupted at the top. And then they begin to use their surveillance powers, their entrapment powers, their militaristic powers, and they begin to target political opponents. This we've actually seen clear evidence of in the Michael Flynn case. I saw a glimpse of it in my own case. It's become actually quite pervasive in American politics. I think it's a corruption we have to root out, because thugs with badges are actually more dangerous than thugs on the street.
How close are we to socialism in this country?
I don't think we're going to go there, because I think that Americans realize that it would be an absolute disaster. It's the very antithesis of what America was built on. Even Marx recognized that America was sort of the anti-socialist country par excellence. So I think the ordinary American still believes in the work ethic, still doesn't want to sit on the couch, believes in earned gratification. There's no substitute for that. I mean, someone can come to me and tell me I'm the greatest guy in the world, I'm the greatest basketball player, but until I jump in the air and slam the ball into the hoop, then I get that earned gratification of realizing, you know, I did it. I wrote the paper that got an A. I made something that consumers actually want. So I think that Americans love that. They love to compete. They have that creative spirit. So I don't think the socialists in the end are going to be able to crush that.
How about fascism? What about the possibility of that occurring?
Well, the problem with fascism is it actually begins to have a kind of outward appeal when law and order breaks down.
Yes.
Remember that fascism became popular in Europe in the interregnum between the wars. It was the cataclysm of the First World War, the humiliation of Versailles, also the kind of lawlessness on the street, where ultimately a guy like Mussolini, a kind of mob boss, if you will, or even Hitler could say, listen, if you turn power over to me, I'll straighten things out. I'll save you.
Get
the hoodlums off the street.
Yep, exactly. And that's a danger, because, you know, we're leading toward this, you know, by, I love our police departments. There are bad apples in every basket. And what happened in Minneapolis was unacceptable by any means, unacceptable. You know, I got an email from someone that said, yeah, but George, you're not pointing out that Floyd was a criminal, that he did this and drug charges and he, you know, armed robbery into a house. And he did all this. He tried to pass a phony $20 bill. It's not the point. You don't kill the guy over that.
Exactly. Not to mention the fact that the police does not get to be the judge, jury and executioner.
Exactly. Let's take some calls for you. Mike in Denver, Colorado. Michael, go ahead.
George, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And Dinesh, thank you so much for all of your work and contributions to, you know, my generation, which is the millennials. I heard you on Mike Rosen's show last week on 850 KOA here in Denver, and I really enjoyed your interview. I had a comment and a question tonight. The narrative around socialism and millennials, it's kind of, you know, sad, because we're said by many people that we don't want to work for things, we want handouts from the government. And, you know, it's unfortunate, because there's so many of us who are very, you know, passionate about things, but we can't just, you know, call into CNN or MTV and talk about, you know, current issues. And that's what Coast to Coast gives us the opportunity to do so. But, you know, it's interesting, because I feel like a lot of millennials cannot relate to Trump. And I think that might hurt him at the polls, because a lot of us kind of grew up with Joe Biden, of course. But, you know, my question for you, Joe Biden and Obama, but my question for you, Dinesh, is what can we do, you know, as millennials to change the narrative that, you know, we don't just want handouts from the government and we don't want this socialistic kind of regime. We do want to work. And how can we change that narrative? Thank you.
I think that it's really important for millennials to question the narratives that are, in the end of the day, not taught by Biden or by the Democratic Party, but are actually entrenched in academia. Now, when I was a student at Dartmouth a generation ago, there was a liberal tilt in academia, but it wasn't a monopoly. In fact, I could name off the top of my head a half dozen prominent conservatives who taught at Dartmouth. The same was true, for example, of Harvard. But today, you're often hard-pressed to name one. And if there is one, he's usually hiding under his desk and refuses to sign his name to anything and so on. So in other words, what we have now is this kind of tyrannical atmosphere in which a narrative is enforced. and young people are sort of treated as being enlightened if they embrace it, and sort of reactionary and hateful if they don't. The word hate itself doesn't now apply to actual haters. It applies to basically dissenters, people who disagree with the narrative and won't go along with it. So I think millennials, in a way, their spirit is being crushed because they're not allowed to have that Socratic investigation, to be able to really ask tough questions, to be able to say even refreshing things like, listen, I keep hearing racism talked about everywhere, but I never see it. I live on a campus where people do backward somersaults to accommodate blacks and other minorities. They do make every effort not to seem insensitive or intolerant to anyone, and yet all we hear about is racism, racism, racism. So, in other words, where is it really? This kind of discussion, I think, needs to happen, doesn't happen. The people who raise these kinds of questions get bullied and intimidated. So I think, ultimately, poor young people need some room to breathe, and they need some room to think.
Dinesh, would you say that most of the have-nots would embrace socialism?
No. This is the great irony of things. You know, Marx expected that the people who would embrace socialism would be the working class guys, the union guys, the people who would ultimately be kind of doing all the sweat and labor.
Right, the ones who want to be elevated.
You know, they would fight, they would overthrow the system. But the weird thing is, if you look for a working class guy today, you're more likely to find him like in a Trump rally. Today what happens is that socialism has now adopted the politics of not so much the rich against the poor, but blacks against whites, men against women, straights against gays, legals against illegals. So all these other issues of identity politics have now become mixed in with American socialism, giving it, I think, a very unique cast.
In spite of all this, don't you think this president should have done a better job, and there's still room to do it, of uniting the country instead of contributing to the divide?
Well, Trump is, I would call him a certain type of a combative and perhaps even, one may say, wartime president. Now, I obviously don't mean that we are in a civil war, but we're in a little bit of a cold civil war. And in those abnormal conditions, you tend to get abnormal men, people who would not be president under normal times. I think Trump is a lot like that. Now, like I said earlier, the abnormal situation wasn't created by Trump. See, I think Republicans have tried to nominate for really now 3 decades, one Boy Scout after another, George H.W. Bush, Bob Dole, John McCain, Mitt Romney. Now, you couldn't find people more decent, more civilized, with a perfect resume, happy marriages, and on the list you go. And yet, what happens? The moment they step into the arena, they become demonized.
Right. Stay with us, Dinesh. We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk more and take final calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Pastor Paul Begley joins us. We'll talk about the apocalypse, so make sure you're part of Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, as we get into more phone calls and discussion, where do people get your book, United States of Socialism?
Well, it's available everywhere, and you can even get it on Audible, where I've read it myself. A good place to start is just to go to my website. It's just DineshD'Souza.com. And you can find out about the book and also a forthcoming movie I have based on the book that's going to be called Trump Card, coming out later in the summer.
I like that title.
Well, I thought it was a witty title, and we were talking a little earlier about Trump, and I was just finishing the point that, you know, I think Republicans tried nominating one kind of nice guy and one Boy Scout after another, and when they saw how these guys were abused, they finally said, wow, if the other side is going to play rough, maybe we need sort of a tough guy on our side. I think that's really how we got Trump.
And it was such an anti-Hillary vote, too, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think with Hillary, and this is something that's very bad, I think, in American politics, is you have these politicians who are able to go from like zero to $100 million on a government salary. Now, if they make the iPhone or start Amazon Prime or they start a business, you know, we don't begrudge them because they've created products that have made people's lives better. But when you see Al Gore making, you know, tens of millions of dollars on climate change or the Bidens, and the interesting thing about Biden is if you look at his career over 40 years, his net worth has remained about the same. But the net worth of his brother, James Biden, his other brother, Frank Biden, his son, Hunter Biden, all begin to grow to massive amounts. And you realize, wow, isn't this sad? Because in other countries we see this, you know, families getting rich, if you will, through political connections. I was hoping to have left that kind of corruption behind. But, hey, here it is in America.
How upsetting, evil, whatever you want to call it, is George Soros? I hear all kinds of things about this guy.
I think he is motivated at the root by a hatred for America. Now, I don't know if it's based on some kind of weird European grudge that the center of the world has moved, if you will, away from Europe and toward America in the post-war era. I don't really know. But he is clearly a sort of, you may almost call him a kind of a, you know, an organizer of unrest throughout the country. He bankrolls a lot of even local races to get cops, you know, prosecuted and DAs overthrown. And so he's ultimately an agitator of, I think, a very alarming sort. Now, probably what he's doing is legal, but I don't think it's helpful.
No, not at all. Let's go back to some calls here for you, Dinesh. They're lining up. Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, welcome. Go ahead.
Hi, Dinesh. Going over historical references, I don't see it the way you're presenting it. For example, I read the Red Book, Mao's Red Book. I thought it was actually pretty good. But when we reference Hitler, I don't know that Hitler was the puppet master in Nazi Germany. We don't understand his speeches. I don't know a stitch of German. So it's hard to say who was running the show, who were the real puppet masters. I see an example more like ancient Rome with Nero. Now, Nero not only wanted to burn down Rome, he enjoyed it. He enjoyed the process. And why did Rome get Nero? Because maybe they let too much violence seep into the society on the outskirts. They had the Colosseum. People were killed for entertainment purposes. So they kind of let that fester. It ingrained. And all of a sudden they get someone like Nero who burns down Rome, different sections of it every night, and plays the fiddle to it and sings some songs. So we enjoyed the process. It's like that movie, Apocalypse Now. A key character says, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. They love the process. So I see it as bleaker. I see it as these people are killers, and we've let them fester, and now we've got them, and they're out to kill everybody.
And now when you say they, you don't have to give us specific names, but what types of people, Joe, are you talking about?
I'm talking about some of the politicians, and I'm talking about some of the elite scientists.
Well, the scientists probably. What do you think about the rest, Dinesh?
Well, I think he's talking about the way in which societies, even very intelligent and cultured societies, become decadent and collapse. Rome was, of course, the pinnacle of Western civilization at one time, but it became decadent. And ultimately, it was smashed by the barbarian hordes coming in from the north, the Huns and the Lombards and so on. An interesting thing about Hitler is that if you Google the Nazi 20-point platform of 1920, this is, by the way, what the Nazis campaigned on. This was their official platform. You'll be really surprised because you'll see that it's all about state control of business, state control of the banks, state control of education, state control of healthcare, state control of the churches. So here are these progressive academics who keep telling us the Nazis were right-wing, and yet none of this is even familiar to any right-winger or conservative. Trump would certainly not be on board. This is basically the agenda of socialism, for the state to take over the organs of the society. So I'm not sure if I agree with you about your comments about Hitler per se, but I do want to highlight this kind of left-wing aspect of National Socialism, one that has been swept under the rug by progressive historiography.
Dinesh, would you call government socialistic if it was really set up not to get involved with stopping people from being entrepreneurs and making as much money as they have? They'd still have the Jeff Bezos and the Bill Gates, and those folks would do their thing, but to uplift the lifestyle of people who couldn't afford other things. So, you know, you try to get the homeless off the streets, and you try to help people with more medical care and stuff like that. I don't see that socialistic.
That's not socialism at all. That's what you would call the safety net, which would be in a society that has reached a certain level of affluence. You say, listen, we don't want people to be starving on the street. We want to be able to give people a start. We want to ultimately make sure that people have a hot meal and a place, a roof over their heads. And so that, but remember, the only debate about that is, how is that best done? Is that best done by the federal government, or is it best done at the local level? When Tocqueville wrote about America a century and a half ago, a lot of those functions were done by civic institutions and churches and voluntary associations. They weren't done by government per se. But if you're making the point that they should be done one way or the other, I agree completely.
I mean, I would create homeless cities. I would build huge apartment complexes for the homeless who can't afford to live, and, you know, give them some respectability, some kind of lifestyle. Look at all the money we've given out in these stimulus checks. Why can't we, you know, I don't know if homeless people get unemployment or not. They probably don't. Why can't we help them with a little cash every once in a while?
Yeah, the homeless problem is actually a little specific, because a lot of these guys are actually alcoholics or drug addicts. And in fact, going back to the 1980s and early 90s, there were actually places for these guys to sleep and get a hot meal and even get medical care. But then somebody filed a lawsuit saying that you cannot confine the homeless against their will. It violates their civil rights. And so the courts decided that these homeless guys could not be institutionalized. They must be let out to live as they wish. And so the homeless, as we recognize them now, living in shanties and tents and sort of this kind of unbelievable sight on the streets of Los Angeles.
Oh, it's horrible.
That is a relatively modern phenomenon.
Next up, let's go to Mark in New Hampshire. Go ahead, Mark. Good to have you with us.
George and Dinesh. George, thank you for having Dinesh on.
Thank you.
The voice of enigma, the voice of truth. Maybe why there were, back in the 90s, there were 10 states that passed bills to rescind the Constitution. Everybody must have been watching some night show or something, didn't realize it was happening. We had patriots running across the country trying to stop it. They already have a constitution in print. It's called the Constitution of the Federation Earth. We have the Russian, former Russian president, controls.
Let me try to recycle you real quickly here, Mark. You're breaking up a little bit. Try again. Go ahead. There you go.
We have the former Russian president has controlled the Gorbachev Society of the Presidio, the most highly recognized Navy base in America. I mean, we all wake up one day and realize that we have a ball of confusion in this country. How do you feel about that?
Well, we do have confusion, and I've never seen it so disjointed, Dinesh, in all my life.
Yes, and I have to say that, you know, when I went through my case a few years ago, my own views became a little more radicalized, because I had thought rather naively or innocently about American politics as being nothing more than a kind of debate between two groups of people who had rival sets of principles, and we put those principles before the American people and let them decide. I had no idea that there were so many machinations going on behind the scenes, no idea that, for example, RICO statutes that were passed to go after, you know, the mafia and ISIS would then be used against American citizens, no idea that the FBI would go to talk to General Flynn and basically have nothing on him but try to interview him for hours and hours and find two statements that contradicted each other so that they could then accuse him of lying to a federal official and then threaten to ruin his family if he didn't plead guilty. I mean, all of this stuff happening in America, who would have believed it if the documents didn't come out to support it?
Well, absolutely. Couple more calls here and we are out of time, Dinesh. And what kind of response are you getting nationwide to United States of Socialism? You're getting some media pickups?
Oh, yeah, the book has actually struck a big chord. It just hit the New York Times bestseller list. I think the remarkable thing is with coronavirus and the riots, people realize that something very fundamental is changing in this country. Things we took for granted in America, we can't take for granted anymore. So the book is a kind of roadmap to how we got here, the direction that some people want to take us, and what we have to do if we don't want to go there, how to stop them.
Let's go to Stephanie in Juneau, Alaska. Hi, Steph. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, George, thank you. Thank you for having him on.
You're very welcome.
And God, thank you. And anyone out there, go to YouTube and listen to this man. He is absolutely amazing. So, Dinesh, Hillary's America and America the Video. I ordered like 10 of them and gave them to everybody. I don't know. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, the song, there was a song, these guys are in a sailboat, it's at the very end of the video of America, I think it was America. Would you please put that on YouTube? That is the best song. It was like a rock version of the national anthem.
Oh, yes. You know, that was the national anthem played by played in rock style by, I think the group is called Madison Rising. So look them up on YouTube. Because
right. They have the rights to that song,
I
guess.
They have the rights to that song. They're awesome, and this is, I think, their best song.
So of all the presidents you've been here under, which one do you think is the best?
Well, you know, I was... I kind of came of age in the Reagan era, and there was something about Reagan that to me represented the kind of big sky conservatism that I've always embraced. It was optimistic, forward-looking, and it appealed, I think, to the best in the American spirit. Of course, Reagan was massively successful because I think he played a critical role in bringing down the Soviet Union. In Margaret Thatcher's words, he won the Cold War without firing a shot. So I have a real soft spot and a nostalgia for Reagan. He also represented, I think, a kinder, gentler America than the one we have now. And I'm hoping that at some point we can get back to that.
I agree. What do you think of Vladimir Putin out of Russia?
A thug, a gangster. He is an improvement over the kind of old Soviet dictators like Lenin and Stalin, but nevertheless, he's a bad guy and somebody we need to kind of watch out for.
I mean, he is, within himself, he's a capitalist, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a very talented guy. He's a Machiavellian. He's an entrepreneur. He's also kind of a gangster. And so the capitalism he represents, though, is not the capitalism that respects free markets and contracts and property rights. If they're a powerful businessman and he doesn't like them, he just puts them in jail.
He crushes them. But he's taking care of himself. He's one of the world's richest individuals, isn't he?
And that would be no surprise. So by the way, is the family of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, again, is supposedly a socialist, but this is the clan of socialist billionaires.
Citgo, the gas stations, I wonder where a lot of that money went to, right?
Well, it's partly owned by the Venezuelan government, and so part of the money today does go to the regime.
That'll tell you. Dinesh, thank you again for being on the program. Take care of yourself, and you've got guts to do what you do, United States of Socialism. Up next, we'll talk a little bit about the apocalypse right here on Coast to Coast AM. So don't touch your dial. Keep it right where it is on your favorite radio station. We will be back.